and sided with the fascists, how could the counter-demonstrators resist them? This was worse than a fascist march. It was a fascist march with police authority. What kind of message did that send to the Jews of the East End? In Mansell Street, he saw a beat policeman he knew, Henry Clark. "Hello, Nobby," he said. For some reason, all Clarks were called Nobby. "A copper just gave me the Hitler salute."
"They're not from round here," Nobby said quietly, as if revealing a confidence.
"They don't live with Jews like I do. I tell them Jews are the same as everyone else. Mostly decent, law-abiding people. A few villains and troublemakers. But they don't believe me.
All the same, the Hitler salute? Might have been a joke."
Lloyd did not think so. He left Nobby and moved on. The police were forming cordons where the side streets entered the area around Gardner's Corner, he saw. He went into a pub with a phone. He had scouted all the available telephones the day before, and told Bernie there were at least 5,000 policemen in the neighborhood.
"We can't resist that many coppers," he said gloomily.
"Don't be so sure," Bernie said. "Have a look at Gardner's Corner." Lloyd found a way around the police cordon and joined the counter-demonstration. It was not until he got into the middle of the street, outside Gardner's, that he could appreciate the full extent of the crowd. It was the largest gathering of people he had ever seen. The five-way junction was jammed, but that was the least of it. The crowd stretched east along Whitechapel High Street, as far as the eye could see. Commercial Road, which ran southeast, was also crammed. Lehman Street, where the police station stood, was impenetrable. There must be 100,000 people here, Lloyd thought. He wanted to throw his hat in the air and cheer. EastEnders had come out in force to repel the fascists. There could be no doubt about their feelings now. In the middle of the junction stood a stationary tram, abandoned by its driver and passengers. Nothing could pass through this crowd, Lloyd realized with mounting optimism. He saw his neighbor, Sean Dolan, climb a lamppost and fix a red flag to its top. The Jewish Lads Brigade brass band was playing, probably without the knowledge of the respectable conservative organizers of the club. A police aircraft flew overhead, an autogyro of some kind, Lloyd thought. Near the windows of Gardner's, he ran into his sister, Millie, and her friend, Naomi Avery. He did not want Millie to become involved in any rough stuff. The thought chilled his heart.
"Does Dad know you've come?" he said in a tone of reproof.
She was insouciant.
"Don't be daft," she replied.
He was surprised she was there at all.
"You're not usually very political," he said.
"I thought you were more interested in making money."
"I am," she said, "but this is special."
Lloyd could imagine how upset Bernie would be if Millie got hurt.
"I think you should go home."
"Why?"
He looked around. The crowd was amiable and peaceful. The police were some distance away. The fascists nowhere to be seen. There would be no march today, that was clear. Mosley's people could not force their way through a crowd of 100,000 people determined to stop them, and the police would be insane to let them try. Millie was probably quite safe. Just as he was thinking this, everything changed. Several whistles shrilled. Looking in the direction of the sound, Lloyd saw the mounted police drawn up in an ominous line. The horses were stamping and blowing in agitation. The police had drawn long clubs shaped like swords. They seemed to be getting ready to attack. But surely that could not be so. Next moment, they charged. There were angry shouts and terrified screams from the people. Everyone scrambled to get out of the way of the giant horses. The crowd made a path, but those at the edge fell under the pounding hooves. The police lashed out left and right with their long clubs. Lloyd was pushed helplessly backward. He felt furious. What did the police think they were doing? Were they stupid enough to believe they could clear a path for Mosley to march along? Did they really imagine that 2,000 or 3,000 fascists, chanting insults, could pass through a crowd of 100,000 of their victims without starting a riot? Were the police led by idiots or out of control? He was not sure which would be worse. They backed away, wheeling their panting horses, and regrouped, forming a ragged line. Then a whistle blew and they heeled the flanks of their mounts, urging them into another reckless charge. Millie was scared now. She was only 16, and her bravado had gone. She screamed with fear as the crowd squeezed her up against the plate-glass window of Gardner and Company. Taylor's dummies in cheap suits and winter coats stared out at the horrified crowd and the warlike riders. Lloyd was deafened by the roar of thousands of voices yelling in fearful protest. He got in front of Millie and pushed against the press with all his might, trying to protect her. But it was in vain. Despite his efforts, he was crushed against her. 40 or 50 screaming people had their backs to the window, and the pressure was building dangerously. Lloyd realized with rage that the police were determined to make a pathway through the crowd regardless of the cost. A moment later there was a terrific crash of breaking glass, and the window gave way. Lloyd fell on top of Millie, and Naomi fell on him. Dozens of people cried out in pain and panic. Lloyd struggled to his feet. Miraculously, he was unhurt. He looked around frantically for his sister. It was maddeningly difficult to distinguish the people from the tailor's dummies. Then he spotted Millie lying in a mess of broken glass. He grasped her arms and pulled her to her feet. She was crying.
"My back," she said.
He turned her around. Her coat was cut to ribbons, and there was blood all over her. He felt sick with anguish. He put his arm around her shoulders protectively. "There's an ambulance just around the corner," he said. "Can you walk?" They had gone only a few yards when the police whistles blew again. Lloyd was terrified that he and Millie would be shoved back into Gardner's window. Then he remembered what Bernie had given him. He took the paper bag of marbles from his pocket. The police charged. Drawing back his arm, Lloyd threw the paper bag over the heads of the crowd to land in front of the horses. He was not the only one so equipped, and several other people threw marbles. As the horses came at them, there was the sound of firecrackers. A police horse slipped on marbles and went down. Others stopped and reared at the banging of the fireworks. The police charge turned into chaos. Naomi Avery had somehow pushed to the front of the crowd, and he saw her burst a bag of pepper under the nose of a horse, causing it to veer away, shaking its head frantically. The crush eased, and Lloyd led Millie around the corner. She was still in pain, but she had stopped crying. A line of people were waiting for attention from the St. John Ambulance volunteers. A weeping girl whose hand appeared to have been crushed, several young men with bleeding heads and faces, a middle-aged woman sitting on the ground nursing a swollen knee. As Lloyd and Millie arrived, Sean Dolan walked away with a bandage around his head and went straight back into the crowd. A nurse looked at Millie's back.
"This is bad," she said. "You need to go to the London hospital. We'll take you in an ambulance."
She looked at Lloyd.
"Do you want to go with her?"
Lloyd did, but he was supposed to be phoning in reports, and he hesitated. Millie solved the dilemma for him with characteristic spunk.
"Don't you dare come," she said. "You can't do anything for me, and you've got important work to do here."
She was right. He helped her into a parked ambulance.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, I'm sure.
Try not to end up in hospital yourself."
He was leaving her in the best hands, he decided. He kissed her cheek and returned to the fray. The police had changed their tactics. The people had repelled the horse charges, but the police were still determined to make a path through the crowd. As Lloyd pushed his way to the front, they charged on foot, attacking with their batons. The unarmed demonstrators cowered back from them, like piled leaves in a wind, then surged forward in a different part of the line. The police started to arrest people, perhaps hoping to weaken the crowd's determination by taking ringleaders away. In the East End, being arrested was no legal formality. Few people came back without a black eye or a few gaps in their teeth. Lehman Street Police Station had a particularly bad reputation. Lloyd found himself behind a vociferous young woman carrying a red flag. He recognized Olive Bishop, a neighbor in Nutley Street. A policeman hit her over the head with his truncheon, screaming, "Jewish whore!" She was not Jewish, and she certainly was not a whore. In fact, she played the piano at the Calvary Gospel Hall. But she had forgotten the admonition of Jesus to turn the other cheek, and she scratched the cop's face, drawing parallel red lines on his skin. Two more officers grabbed her arms and held her, while the scratched man hit her on the head again. The sight of three strong men attacking one girl maddened Lloyd. He stepped forward and hit the woman's assailant with a right hook that had all of his rage behind it. The blow landed on the policeman's temple. Dazed, the man stumbled and fell. More officers converged on the scene, lashing out randomly with their clubs, hitting arms and legs and heads and hands. Four of them picked up Olive, each taking an arm or a leg. She screamed and wriggled desperately, but she could not get free. But the bystanders were not passive. They attacked the police carrying the girl off, trying to pull the uniformed men away from her. The police turned on their attackers, yelling, "Jew bastards!" even though not all their assailants were Jews, and one was a black-skinned Somali sailor. The police let go of Olive, dropping her to the road, and began to defend themselves. Olive pushed through the crowd and vanished. The cops retreated, hitting out at anyone within reach as they backed away. Lloyd saw with a thrill of triumph that the police strategy was not working. For all their brutality, the attacks had completely failed to make a way through the crowd. Another baton charge began, but the angry crowd surged forward to meet it, eager now for combat. Lloyd decided it was time for another report. He worked his way backward through the crush and found a phone box. "I don't think they're going to succeed, Dad," he told Bernie excitedly. "They're trying to beat a path through us, but they're making no progress. We're too many." "We're redirecting people to Cable Street," Bernie said. "The police may be about to switch their thrust, thinking they have more chance there, so we're sending reinforcements. Go along there, see what's happening, and let me know." "Right," said Lloyd, and he hung up before realizing he had not told his stepfather that Millie had been taken to hospital. But perhaps it was better not to worry him right now. Getting to Cable Street was not going to be easy. From Gardner's Corner, Lehman Street led directly south to the near end of Cable Street, a distance of less than half a mile. But the road was jammed by demonstrators fighting with police. Lloyd had to take a less direct route. He struggled eastward through the crowd into Commercial Road. Once there, further progress was not much easier. There were no police, therefore there was no violence, but the crowd was almost as dense. It was frustrating, but Lloyd was consoled for his difficulties by the reflection that the police would never force a way through so many. He wondered what Daisy Peshkov was doing. Probably she was sitting in the car, waiting for the march to begin, tapping the toe of her expensive shoe impatiently on the Rolls-Royce's carpet. The thought that he was helping to frustrate her purpose gave him an oddly spiteful sense of satisfaction. With persistence and a slightly ruthless attitude to those in his way, Lloyd pushed through the throng. The railway that ran along the north side of Cable Street obstructed his route, and he had to walk some distance before reaching a side road that tunneled beneath the line. He passed under the tracks and entered Cable Street. The crowd here was not so close-packed, but the street was narrow, and passage was still difficult. That was a good thing. It would be even more difficult for the police to get through. But there was another obstruction he saw. A lorry had been parked across the road and turned on its side. At either end of the vehicle, the barricade had been extended the full width of the street, with old tables and chairs, odd lengths of timber, and other assorted rubbish piled high. A barricade. It made Lloyd think of the French Revolution. But this was no revolution. The people of the East End did not want to overthrow the British government. On the contrary, they were deeply attached to their elections and their borough councils and their houses of parliament. They liked their system of government so much that they were determined to defend it against fascism, even if it would not defend itself. He had emerged behind the barrier, and now he moved toward it to see what was happening. He stood on a wall to get a better view. He saw a lively scene. On the far side, police were trying to dismantle the blockage, picking up broken furniture and dragging old mattresses away. But they were not having an easy time of it. A hail of missiles fell on their helmets, some hurled from behind the barricade, some thrown from the upstairs windows of the houses packed closely on either side of the street. Stones, milk bottles, broken pots, and bricks that came, Lloyd saw, from a nearby builder's yard. A few daring young men stood on top of the barricade, lashing out at the police with sticks, and occasionally a fight would break out as the police tried to pull one down and give him a kicking. With a start, Lloyd recognized two of the figures standing on the barricade as Dave Williams, his cousin, and Lenny Griffiths, from Aberowen. Side by side, they were fighting policemen off with shovels. But as the minutes passed, Lloyd saw that the police were winning. They were working systematically, picking up the components of the barricade and taking them away. On this side, a few people reinforced the wall, replacing what the police removed, but they were less organized and did not have an infinite supply of materials. It looked to Lloyd as if the police would soon prevail, and if they could clear Cable Street, they would let the fascists march down here, past one Jewish shop after another. Then, looking behind him, he saw that whoever was organizing the defense of Cable Street was thinking ahead. Even while the police dismantled the barricade, another was going up a few hundred yards farther along the street. Lloyd retreated and began enthusiastically to help build the second wall. Dockers with pickaxes were prising up paving stones, housewives dragged dustbins from their yards, and shopkeepers brought empty crates and boxes. Lloyd helped carry a park bench, then pulled down a notice board from outside a municipal building. Learning from experience, the builders did a better job this time, using their materials economically and making sure the structure was sturdy. Looking behind him again, Lloyd saw that a third barricade was beginning to rise farther east. The people began to retreat from the first one and regroup behind the second. A few minutes later, the police at last made a gap in the first barricade and poured through it. The first of them went after the few young men remaining, and Lloyd saw Dave and Lenny chased down an alley. The houses on either side were swiftly shut up, doors slamming and windows closing. Then, Lloyd saw, the police did not know what to do next. They had broken through the barricade only to be confronted with another, stronger one. They seemed not to have the heart to begin dismantling the second. They milled around in the middle of Cable Street, talking desultorily, looking resentfully at the residents watching them from upstairs windows. It was too early to proclaim victory, but all the same, Lloyd could not suppress a happy feeling of success. It was beginning to look as if the anti-fascists were going to win the day. He remained at his post for another quarter of an hour, but the police did nothing more, so he left the scene, found a telephone kiosk, and called in. Bernie was cautious. "We don't know what's happening," he said. "There seems to be a lull everywhere, but we need to find out what the fascists are up to. Can you get back to the tower?" Lloyd certainly could not fight his way through the massed police, but perhaps there was another way. "I could try going via St. George Street," he said doubtfully. "Do the best you can. I want to know their next move." Lloyd worked his way south through a maze of alleys. He hoped he was right about St. George Street. It was outside the contested area, but the crowds might have spilled over. However, as he had hoped, there were no crowds there, even though he was still within earshot of the counter-demonstration, and could hear shouting and police whistles. A few women stood in the street talking, and a gaggle of little girls skipped a rope in the middle of the road. Lloyd headed west, breaking into a jog trot, expecting to see crowds of demonstrators or police around every bend. He came across a few people who had strayed from the fracas. Two men with bandaged heads, a woman in a ripped coat, a bemedaled veteran with his arm in a sling. But no crowds. He ran all the way to where the street ended at the tower. He was able to walk unhindered into Tower Gardens. The fascists were still there. That, in itself, was an achievement, Lloyd felt. It was now 3:30. The marchers had been kept waiting here, not marching, for hours. He saw that their high spirits had evaporated. They were no longer singing or chanting, but stood quiet and listless, lined up, but not so neatly, their banners drooping, their bands silent. They already looked beaten. However, there was a change a few minutes later. An open car emerged from a side street and drove along the fascist lines. Cheers went up. The lines straightened. The officers saluted. The fascists stood at attention. In the back seat of the car sat their leader, Sir Oswald Mosley, a handsome man with a mustache, wearing the uniform complete with cap. Rigidly straight-backed, he saluted repeatedly as his car went by at walking pace, as if he were a monarch inspecting his troops. His presence reinvigorated his forces and worried Lloyd. This probably meant they were going to march as planned. Otherwise, why was he here? The car followed the fascist line along a side street into the financial district. Lloyd waited. Half an hour later, Mosley returned, this time on foot, again saluting and acknowledging cheers. When he reached the head of the line, he turned and, accompanied by one of his officers, entered a side street. Lloyd followed. Mosley approached a group of older men standing in a huddle on the pavement. Lloyd was surprised to recognize Sir Philip Game, the Commissioner of Police, in a bow tie and trilby hat. The two men began an intense conversation. Sir Philip must surely be telling Sir Oswald that the crowd of counter-demonstrators was too huge to be dispersed. But what then would be his advice to the fascists? Lloyd longed to get close enough to eavesdrop, but he decided not to risk arrest, and remained at a discreet distance. The police commissioner did most of the talking. The fascist leader nodded briskly several times and asked a few questions. Then the two men shook hands, and Mosley walked away. He returned to the park and conferred with his officers. Among them, Lloyd recognized Boy Fitzherbert, wearing the same uniform as Mosley. Boy did not look so well in it. The trim military outfit did not suit his soft body and the lazy sensuality of his stance. Mosley seemed to be giving orders. The other men saluted and moved away, no doubt to carry out his commands. What had he told them to do? Their only sensible option was to give up and go home. But if they had been sensible, they would not have been fascists. Whistles blew, orders were shouted, bands began to play, and the men stood to attention. They were going to march, Lloyd realized. The police must have assigned them a route. But what route? Then the march began, and they went in the opposite direction. Instead of heading into the East End, they went west, into the financial district, deserted on a Sunday afternoon. Lloyd could hardly believe it. "They've given up," he said aloud, and a man standing near him said, "Looks like it, don't it?" He watched for 5 minutes as the column slowly moved off. When there was absolutely no doubt what was happening, he ran to a phone box and called Bernie. "They're marching away," he said. "What? Into the East End?" "No, the other way. They're going west, into the city. We've won." "Good God!" Bernie spoke to the other people with him. "Everybody, the fascists are marching west. They're giving up." Lloyd heard a burst of wild cheering in the room. After a minute, Bernie said, "Keep an eye on them. Let us know when they've all left Tower Gardens." "Absolutely." Lloyd hung up. He walked around the perimeter of the park in high spirits. It became clearer every minute that the fascists were defeated. Their bands played, and they marched in time, but there was no spring in their step, and they no longer chanted that they were going to get rid of the Yids. The Yids had got rid of them. As he passed the end of Byward Street, he saw Daisy again. She was heading toward the distinctive black and cream Rolls Royce, and she had to walk past Lloyd. He could not resist the temptation to gloat. "The people of the East End have rejected you and your filthy ideas," he said. She stopped and looked at him, cool as ever. "We've been abstracted by a gang of thugs," she said with disdain. "Still, you're marching in the other direction now. One battle doesn't make a war." That might be true, Lloyd thought, but it was a pretty big battle. "You're not marching home with your boyfriend?" "I prefer to drive," she said, "and he's not my boyfriend." Lloyd's heart leaped in hope. Then she said, "He's my husband." Lloyd stared at her. He had never really believed she would be so stupid. He was speechless. "It's true," she said, reading the disbelief in his face. "Didn't you see our engagement reported in the newspapers?" "I don't read the society pages." She showed him her left hand, with a diamond engagement ring and a gold wedding band. "We were married yesterday. We postponed our honeymoon to join the march today. Tomorrow we're flying to Deauville in Boy's plane." She walked the few steps to the car and the chauffeur opened the door. "Home, please," she said. "Yes, my lady." Lloyd was so angry he wanted to hit someone. Daisy looked back over her shoulder. "Goodbye, Mr. Williams." He found his voice. "Goodbye, Miss Peshkov." "Oh, no," she said. "I'm Viscountess Aberowan now." She just loved saying it, Lloyd could tell. She was a titled lady, and it meant the world to her. She got into the car and the chauffeur closed the door. Lloyd turned away. He was ashamed to realize he had tears in his eyes. "Hell," he said aloud. He sniffed, swallowing tears. He squared his shoulders and headed back toward the East End at a brisk walk.
Today's triumph had been soured. He knew he was a fool to care about Daisy. Clearly, she did not care about him. But all the same, it broke his heart that she was throwing herself away on Boy Fitzherbert. He tried to put her out of his mind. The police were getting back into their buses and leaving the scene. Lloyd had not been surprised by their brutality. He had lived in the East End all his life, and it was a rough neighborhood. But their anti-Semitism had shocked him. They had called every woman a Jewish whore, every man a Jew bastard. In Germany, the police had supported the Nazis and sided with the brown shirts. Would they do the same here? Surely not. The crowded gardener's corner had begun to rejoice. The Jewish Lads Brigade band was playing a jazz tune for men and women to dance to, and bottles of whiskey and gin were passed from hand to hand. Lloyd decided to go to the London hospital and check on Millie. Then he decided he should probably go to the Jewish Council headquarters and break the news to Bernie that Millie had been hurt. Before he got any farther, he ran into Lenny Griffiths. "We sent the buggers packing," Lenny said excitedly. "We did too," Lloyd grinned. Lenny lowered his voice. "We beat the fascists here, and we're going to beat them in Spain, too." "When are you leaving?"
"Tomorrow. Me and Dave are catching a train to Paris in the morning."
Lloyd put his arms around Lenny's shoulders.
"I'll come with you," he said.
Chapter 4 1937 Volodya Peshkov bent his head against the driving snow as he walked across the bridge over the Moscow River. He wore a heavy greatcoat, a fur hat, and a stout pair of leather boots. Few Muscovites were so well-dressed. Volodya was lucky. He always had good boots. His father, Grigori, was an army commander. Grigori was not a high flyer. Although he was a hero of the Bolshevik Revolution and a personal acquaintance of Stalin, his career had stalled at some point in the 20s. All the same, the family had always lived comfortably. Volodya himself was a high flyer. After university, he had got into the prestigious Military Intelligence Academy. A year later, he had been posted to Red Army Intelligence Headquarters. His greatest piece of luck had been meeting Werner Frank in Berlin, while his father was a military attaché at the Soviet embassy there. Werner had been at the same school in a more junior class. Learning that young Werner hated fascism, Volodya had suggested to him that he could best oppose the Nazis by spying for the Russians. Werner had been only 14 years old then, but now he was 18, he worked at the Air Ministry, he hated the Nazis even more, and he had a powerful radio transmitter and a codebook. He was resourceful and courageous, taking dreadful risks and gathering priceless information, and Volodya was his contact. Volodya had not seen Werner for 4 years. But he remembered him vividly. Tall, with striking red blonde hair, Werner looked and acted older than he was, and even at 14 he had been enviably successful with women. Werner had recently tipped him off about Markus, a diplomat at the German embassy in Moscow who was secretly a communist. Volodya had sought Markus out and recruited him as a spy. For some months now, Markus had been supplying a stream of reports that Volodya translated into Russian and passed to his boss. The latest was a fascinating account of how pro-Nazi American business leaders were supplying the right-wing Spanish rebels with trucks, tires, and oil. Texaco's chairman, the Hitler-admiring Torquild Rieber, was using the company's tankers to smuggle oil to the rebels in defiance of a specific request from President Roosevelt. Volodya was on his way to meet Markus now. He walked along Kutuzovsky Prospect and turned toward the Kiev station. Their rendezvous today was a working men's bar near the station. They never used the same place twice, but finished each meeting by arranging the next one. Volodya was meticulous about tradecraft. They always used cheap bars or cafes where Markus's diplomatic colleagues would never dream of going. If somehow Markus were to fall under suspicion and be followed by a German counter-espionage agent, Volodya would know, for such a man would stand out from the other customers. This place was called the Ukraine Bar. Like most buildings in Moscow, it was a timber structure. The windows were steamed up, so at least it would be warm inside. But Volodya did not go in immediately.
There were further precautions to be taken. He crossed the street and ducked into the entrance of an apartment house. He stood in the cold hallway, looking out through a small window, watching the bar. He wondered if Marcus would show up. He always had in the past, but Volodya could not feel sure. If he did show up, what information would he bring? Spain was the hot issue in international politics, but Red Army intelligence was also passionately interested in German armaments. How many tanks were they producing per month? How many Mauser M34 machine guns per day? How good was the new Heinkel HE-111 bomber? Volodya longed for such information to pass to his boss, Major Lemitov. Half an hour went by, and Marcus did not come. Volodya began to worry. Had Marcus been found out? He worked as assistant to the ambassador, and therefore saw everything that crossed the ambassador's desk. But Volodya had been urging him to seek access to other documents, especially the correspondence of military attachés. Had that been a mistake? Had someone noticed Marcus sneaking a peek at cables that were none of his business? Then Marcus came along the street, a professorial figure in spectacles and an Austrian-style lodenkoat, white snowflakes spotting the green felt cloth. He turned into the Ukraine bar. Volodya waited, watching. Another man followed Marcus in, and Volodya frowned anxiously. But the second man was obviously a Russian worker, not a German counter-espionage agent. He was a small, rat-faced man in a threadbare coat, his boots wrapped in rags, and he wiped the wet end of his pointed nose with his sleeve. Volodya crossed the street and went into the bar. It was a smoky place, none too clean, and it smelled of men who did not often bathe. On the walls were fading watercolors of Ukrainian scenery in cheap frames. It was mid-afternoon, and there were not many customers. The only woman in the place looked like an aging prostitute recovering from a hangover. Marcus was at the back of the room, hunched over an untasted glass of beer. He was in his 30s but looked older, with a neat, fair beard and mustache. He had thrown open his coat, revealing a fur lining. The rat-faced Russian sat two tables away, rolling a cigarette. As Volodya approached, Marcus stood up and punched him in the mouth. "You cow fucker!" he screamed in German. "You pig's cunt!" Volodya was so shocked that for a moment he did nothing. His lips hurt, and he tasted blood. Reflexively, he raised his arm to hit back, but he restrained himself. Marcus swung at him again. But this time Volodya was ready, and he easily dodged the wild blow. "Why did you do it?" Marcus yelled. "Why?" Then, just as suddenly, he crumpled, falling back into his chair, burying his face in his hands and beginning to sob. Volodya spoke through bleeding lips. "Shut up, you fool," he said. He turned around and spoke to the other customers, who were all staring. "It's nothing. He's upset." They all looked away and one man left. Muscovites never voluntarily got involved in trouble. It was dangerous even to separate two scrapping drunks, in case one of them was powerful in the party. And they knew that Volodya was such a man. They could tell by his good coat. Volodya turned back to Marcus. In a lowered voice, he said angrily, "What the hell was that for?" He spoke German. Marcus's Russian was poor. "You arrested Irina," the man replied, weeping. "You fucking bastard! You burnt her nipples with a cigarette!" Volodya winced. Irina was Marcus's Russian girlfriend. Volodya began to see what this might be about, and he had a bad feeling. He sat down opposite Marcus. "I didn't arrest Irina," he said, "and I'm sorry if she's been hurt. Just tell me what happened." "They came for her in the middle of the night. Her mother told me. They wouldn't say who they were, but they weren't regular police detectives. They had better clothes. She doesn't know where they took her. They questioned her about me and accused her of being a spy. They tortured her and raped her. Then they threw her out." "Fuck," said Volodya. "I'm really sorry." "You're sorry? It must have been you that did it. Who else? This is nothing to do with army intelligence, I swear." "Makes no difference," Marcus said. "I'm finished with you, and I'm finished with communism. There are sometimes casualties in the war against capitalism.
It sounded glib even to Volodya as he said it.
You young fool,
Marcus said savagely. Don't you understand that socialism means freedom from this kind of shit? Volodya glanced up and saw a burly man in a leather coat come through the door. He was not here for a drink, Volodya knew instinctively. Something was going on, and Volodya did not know what it was. He was new to this game, and right now he felt his lack of experience like a missing limb. He thought he might be in danger, but he did not know what to do. The newcomer approached the table where Volodya sat with Marcus. Then the rat-faced man stood up. He was about the same age as Volodya. Surprisingly, he spoke with an educated accent.
You two are under arrest.
Volodya cursed. Marcus jumped to his feet.
I am commercial attaché at German embassy,
he screamed in ungrammatical Russian.
You cannot arrest. I have diplomatic immunity.
The other customers left the bar in a rush, shoving at each other as they squeezed through the door. Only two people remained. The bartender, nervously swiping at the counter with a filthy rag, and the prostitute, smoking a cigarette and staring into an empty vodka glass.
You can't arrest me either,
Volodya said calmly. He took his identification card from his pocket. I'm Lieutenant Peshkov, Army Intelligence.
Who the fuck are you?
Dvorkin, NKVD.
The man in the leather coat said,
Berezovsky, NKVD.
The secret police. Volodya groaned. He might have known. The NKVD overlapped with Army Intelligence. He had been warned that the two organizations were always treading on each other's toes, but this was his first experience of it. He said to Dvorkin,
I suppose it was you who tortured this man's girlfriend.
Dvorkin wiped his nose on his sleeve. Apparently that unpleasant habit was not part of his disguise.
She had no information. So you burned her nipples for nothing.
Lucky for her. If she had been a spy, it would have been worse. It didn't occur to you to check with us first.
When did you ever check with us?
Marcus said, I'm leaving. Volodya felt desperate. He was about to lose a valuable asset.
Don't go, he pleaded. We'll make this up to Irina somehow. We'll get her the best hospital treatment.
Fuck you,
said Marcus. You'll never see me again. He walked out of the bar. Dvorkin evidently did not know what to do. He did not want to let Marcus go, but clearly he could not arrest him without looking foolish. In the end, he said to Volodya,
You shouldn't let people speak to you that way. It makes you look weak. They should respect you.
You prick,
Volodya said. Can't you see what you've done?
That man was a good source of reliable intelligence, but now he'll never work for us again, thanks to your blundering.
Dvorkin shrugged.
As you said to him, sometimes there are casualties.
God spare me,
Volodya said, and he went out. He felt vaguely nauseated as he walked back across the river. He was sickened by what the NKVD had done to an innocent woman, and downcast by the loss of his source. He boarded a tram. He was too junior to have a car. He brooded as the vehicle trundled through the snow to his place of work. He had to report to Major Lemitov, but he hesitated, wondering how to tell the story. He needed to make it clear that he was not to blame, yet avoid seeming to make excuses. Army Intelligence Headquarters stood on one edge of the Khudinka airfield, where a patient snowplow crawled up and down, keeping the runway clear. The architecture was peculiar. A two-story building with no windows in its outer walls surrounded a courtyard in which stood the nine-story head office, sticking up like a pointed finger out of a brick fist. Cigarette lighters and fountain pens could not be brought in, as they might set off the metal detectors at the entrance, so the army provided its staff with one of each inside. Belt buckles were a problem, too, so most people wore suspenders. The security was superfluous, of course. Muscovites would do anything to stay out of such buildings. No one was mad enough to want to sneak inside. Volodya shared an office with three other subalterns, their steel desks side by side on opposite walls. There was so little space that Volodya's desk prevented the door from opening fully. The office wit, Kamin, looked at his swollen lips and said,
Let me guess. Her husband came home early.
Don't ask, said Volodya.
On his desk was a decrypt from the radio section.
the German words penciled letter by letter under the code groups. The message was from Werner. Volodya's first reaction was fear. Had Markus already reported what had happened to Irina, and persuaded Werner, too, to withdraw from espionage? Today seemed a sufficiently unlucky day for such a disaster. But the message was the opposite of disastrous. Volodya read with growing amazement. Werner explained that the German military had decided to send spies to Spain posing as anti-fascist volunteers wanting to fight for the government side in the civil war. They would report clandestinely from behind the lines to German manned listening stations in the rebel camp. This, in itself, was red-hot information. But there was more. Werner had the names. Volodya had to restrain himself from whooping with joy. A coup like this could happen only once in the lifetime of an intelligence man, he thought. It more than made up for losing Markus. Werner was solid gold. Volodya dreaded to think what risks he must have taken to purloin this list of names and smuggle it out of Air Ministry headquarters in Berlin. He was tempted to run upstairs to Lamitov's office right away, but he restrained himself. The four subalterns shared a typewriter. Volodya lifted the heavy old machine off Carmen's desk and put it on his own. Using the forefinger of each hand, he typed out a Russian translation of the message from Werner. While he was doing so, the daylight faded, and powerful security lights came on outside the building. Leaving a carbon copy in his desk drawer, he took the top copy and went upstairs. Lemitov was in. A good-looking man of about 40, he had dark hair slicked down with brilliantine. He was shrewd, and had a knack of thinking one step ahead of Volodya, who strove to emulate his forethought. He did not subscribe to the orthodox military view that army organization was about shouting and bullying, yet he was merciless with incompetent people. Volodya respected him and feared him.
"This might be tremendously useful information," Lemitov said, when he had read the translation.
Might be. Volodya did not see any reason for doubt.
It could be disinformation,
Lemitov pointed out. Volodya did not want to believe that, but he realized, with a surge of disappointment, that he had to acknowledge the possibility that Werner had been caught and turned into a double agent.
What kind of disinformation?
He asked dispiritedly. Are these false names to send us on a wild goose chase?
Perhaps. Or they might be the real names of genuine volunteers, communists and socialists who have escaped from Nazi Germany and gone to Spain to fight for freedom. We could end up arresting real anti-fascists.
Hell. Lemitov smiled.
Don't look so miserable. The information is still very good. We have our own spies in Spain, young Russian soldiers and officers who have volunteered to join the international brigades. They can investigate.
He picked up a red pencil and wrote on the sheet of paper in small, neat handwriting.
Well done, he said.
Volodya took that for dismissal and went to the door. Lemitov said,
Did you meet Markus today?
Volodya turned back.
There was a problem.
I guessed by your mouth.
Volodya told the story. So I lost a good source, he finished. But I don't know what I could have done differently. Should I have told the NKVD about Markus and warned them off?
Fuck no, said Lemitov. They're completely untrustworthy. Never tell them anything. But don't worry. You haven't lost Markus. You can get him back easily.
How? Volodya said uncomprehendingly.
He hates us all now. Arrest Irina again.
What? Volodya was horrified. Had she not suffered enough?
Then he'll hate us even more. Tell him that if he doesn't continue to cooperate with us, we'll interrogate her all over again.
Volodya tried desperately to hide his revulsion. It was important not to appear squeamish, and he could see that Lemitov's plan would work.
Yes,
he managed to say.
Only this time, Lemitov went on, tell him we'll put the lighted cigarettes up her cunt.
Volodya felt as if he might vomit. He swallowed hard and said,
Good idea. I'll pick her up now.
Tomorrow is soon enough, said Lemitov. 4 in the morning. Maximum shock.
Yes, sir.
Volodya went out and closed the door behind him. He stood in the corridor for a moment, feeling unsteady. Then a passing clerk looked strangely at him, and he forced himself to walk away. He was going to have to do this. He would not torture Irina, of course. The threat would be enough. But she would surely think she was going to be tortured all over again, and that would terrify her out of her wits. Volodya felt that in her place he might go insane. He had never imagined, when he joined the Red Army, that he might have to do such things. Of course, the army was about killing people, he knew that. But torturing girls? The building was emptying, lights being switched off in the offices, men with hats on in the corridors. It was time to go home. Returning to his office, Volodya called the military police and arranged to meet a squad at 3:30 in the morning to arrest Irina. Then he put on his coat and went to catch a tram home. Volodya lived with his parents, Grigory and Katerina, and his sister, Anya, 19, who was still at university. On the tram he wondered if he could talk to his father about this. He imagined saying, "Do we have to torture people in a communist society?" But he knew what the answer would be. It was a temporary necessity, essential to defend the revolution against spies and subversives in the pay of the capitalist imperialists. Perhaps he could ask, "How long will it be until we can abandon such dreadful practices?" Of course his father would not know, nor would anyone else. On their return from Berlin, the Peshkov family had moved into Government House, sometimes called the House on the Embankment, an apartment block across the river from the Kremlin, occupied by members of the Soviet elite. It was a huge building in the constructivist style, with more than 500 flats. Volodya nodded at the military policeman at the door, then passed through the grand lobby, so large that some evenings there was dancing to a jazz band, and went up in the elevator. The apartment was luxurious by Soviet standards, with constant hot water and a phone, but it was not as pleasant as their home in Berlin. His mother was in the kitchen. Katerina was an indifferent cook and an unenthusiastic housekeeper, but Volodya's father adored her. Back in 1914, in St. Petersburg, he had rescued her from the unwelcome attentions of a bullying policeman, and he had been in love with her ever since. She was still attractive at 43, Volodya guessed, and while the family had been on the diplomatic circuit, she had learned how to dress more stylishly than most Russian women, though she was careful not to look Western, a serious offense in Moscow. "Did you hurt your mouth?" she said to him after he kissed her hello. "It's nothing." Volodya smelled chicken. "Special dinner? Anya is bringing a boyfriend home." "Ah, a fellow student?" "I don't think so. I'm not sure what he does." Volodya was pleased. He was fond of his sister, but he knew she was not beautiful. She was short and stumpy, and wore dull clothes in drab colors. She had not had many boyfriends, and it was good news that one liked her enough to come home with her. He went to his room, took off his jacket, and washed his face and hands. His lips were almost back to normal. Markus had not hit him very hard. While he was drying his hands, he heard voices, and gathered that Anya and her boyfriend had arrived. He put on a knitted cardigan for comfort and left his room. He went into the kitchen. Anya was sitting at the table with a small, rat-faced man Volodya recognized. "Oh, no," Volodya said. "You." It was Ilya Dvorkin, the NKVD agent who had arrested Irina. His disguise had gone, and he was dressed in a normal dark suit and decent boots. He stared at Volodya in surprise. "Of course. Peshkov," he said. "I didn't make the connection." Volodya turned to his sister. "Don't tell me this is your boyfriend." Anya said in dismay, "What's the matter?" Volodya said, "We met earlier today. He screwed up an important army operation by sticking his nose in where it didn't belong." "I was doing my job," said Dvorkin. He wiped the end of his nose on his sleeve. "Some job." Katerina stepped in to rescue the situation. "Don't bring your work home," she said. "Volodya, please pour a glass of vodka for our guest." Volodya said, "Really?" His mother's eyes flashed anger. "Really? Okay." Reluctantly, he took the bottle from the shelf. Anya got glasses from a cupboard and Volodya poured. Katerina took a glass and said, "Now, let's start again. Ilya, this is my son Vladimir.
who we always call Volodya. Volodya, this is Anya's friend Ilya, who has come to dinner. Why don't you shake hands?
Volodya had no option but to shake the man's hand. Katerina put snacks on the table. Smoked fish, pickled cucumber, sliced sausage.
In summer we have salad that I grow at the dacha, but at this time of year, of course, there is nothing, she said apologetically.
Volodya realized she was keen to impress Ilya. Did his mother really want Anya to marry this creep? He supposed she must. Grigori came in wearing his army uniform, all smiles, sniffing the chicken and rubbing his hands together. At 48 he was red-faced and corpulent. It was hard to imagine him storming the Winter Palace as he had in 1917. He must have been thinner then. He kissed his wife with relish. Volodya thought his mother was thankful for his father's unabashed lust, without actually returning it. She would smile when he patted her bottom, hug him when he embraced her, and kiss him as often as he wanted. But she was never the initiator. She liked him, respected him, and seemed happy being married to him. But clearly she did not burn with desire. Volodya would want more than that from marriage. The matter was purely hypothetical. Volodya had had a dozen or so short-term girlfriends, but had not yet met a woman he wanted to marry. Volodya poured his father a shot of vodka, and Grigori tossed it back with relish, then took some smoked fish.
So, Ilya, what work do you do?
I'm with the NKVD, Ilya said proudly.
Ah, a very good organization to belong to.
Grigori did not really think this, Volodya suspected. He was just trying to be friendly. Volodya thought the family should be unfriendly, in the hope that they could drive Ilya away. He said, I suppose, father, that when the rest of the world follows the Soviet Union in adopting the communist system, there will no longer be a need for the secret police, and the NKVD can then be abolished. Grigori chose to treat the question lightly.
No police at all, he said jovially. No criminal trials, no prisons, no counter-espionage department, as there will be no spies. No army, either, since we will have no enemies. What will we all do for a living?
He laughed heartily.
This, however, may still be some distance in the future.
Ilya looked suspicious, as if he felt something subversive was being said, but could not put his finger on it. Katerina brought to the table a plate of black bread and 5 bowls of hot borscht, and they all began to eat.
When I was a boy in the countryside, Grigori said, all winter long my mother would save vegetable peelings, apple cores, the discarded outer leaves of cabbages, the hairy part of the onion, anything like that, in a big old barrel outside the house where it all froze. Then in the spring, when the snow melted, she would use it to make borscht. That's what borscht really is, you know. Soup made from peelings. You youngsters have no idea how well off you are.
There was a knock at the door. Grigori frowned, not expecting anyone. But Katerina said,
oh, I forgot. Konstantin's daughter is coming.
Grigori said, you mean Zoya Vorotzinstev, the daughter of Magda the midwife?
I remember Zoya, said Volodya, skinny kid with blonde ringlets.
She's not a kid anymore, Katerina said. She's 24 and a scientist.
She stood up to go to the door. Grigori frowned.
We haven't seen her since her mother died. Why has she suddenly made contact?
She wants to talk to you,
Katerina replied.
To me? About what?
Physics.
Katerina went out. Grigori said proudly,
her father, Konstantin, and I were delegates to the Petrograd Soviet in 1917. We issued the famous Order Number 1.
His face darkened.
He died, sadly,
after the Civil War.
Volodya said,
he must have been young. What did he die of?
Grigori glanced at Ilya and quickly looked away.
Pneumonia,
he said, and Volodya knew he was lying. Katerina returned, followed by a woman who took Volodya's breath away. She was a classic Russian beauty, tall and slim, with light blonde hair, blue eyes so pale they were almost colorless, and perfect white skin. She wore a simple Nile green dress, whose plainness only drew attention to her slender figure. She was introduced all around.
Then she sat at the table and accepted a bowl of borscht. Grigori said,
"So, Zoya, you're a scientist."
"I'm a graduate student doing my doctorate, and I teach undergraduate classes," she said.
"The Lodgy here works in Red Army Intelligence," Grigori said proudly.
"How interesting," she said, obviously meaning the opposite. Volodya realized that Grigori saw Zoya as a potential daughter-in-law. He hoped his father would not hint at this too heavily. He had already made up his mind to ask her for a date before the end of the evening, but he could manage that by himself. He did not need his father's help. On the contrary, unsubtle parental boasting might put her off.
"How is the soup?" Katerina asked Zoya.
"Delicious, thank you." Volodya was already getting the impression of a matter-of-fact personality behind the gorgeous exterior. It was an intriguing combination, a beautiful woman who made no attempt to charm. Anya cleared away the soup bowls, while Katerina brought the main course, chicken and potatoes cooked in a pot. Zoya tucked in, stuffing the food into her mouth, chewing and swallowing and eating more. Like most Russians, she did not often see food this good. Volodya said, "What kind of science do you do, Zoya?" With evident regret, she stopped eating to answer.
"I'm a physicist," she said. "We're trying to understand the atom, what its components are, what holds them together."
"Is that interesting?"
"Completely fascinating."
She put down her fork.
"We're finding out what the universe is really made of. There's nothing so exciting."
Her eyes lit up. Apparently, physics was the one thing that could distract her from her dinner. Ilya spoke up for the first time.
"Ah, but how does all this theoretical stuff help the revolution?"
Zoya's eyes blazed anger, and Volodya liked her even more.
"Some comrades make the mistake of undervaluing pure science, preferring practical research," she said, "but technical developments, such as improved aircraft, are ultimately based on theoretical advances."
Volodya concealed a grin. Ilya had been demolished with one casual swipe. But Zoya had not finished.
"This is why I wanted to talk to you, sir," she said to Grigori. "We physicists read all the scientific journals published in the West. They foolishly reveal their results to the whole world, and we have lately realized that they are making alarming forward leaps in their understanding of atomic physics. Soviet science is in grave danger of falling behind. I wonder if Comrade Stalin is aware of this."
The room went quiet. The merest hint of a criticism of Stalin was dangerous.
"He knows most things," Grigori said.
"Of course,"
Zoya said automatically, "but perhaps there are times when loyal comrades, such as yourself, need to draw important matters to his attention."
"Yes, that's true,"
Ilya said. "Undoubtedly, Comrade Stalin believes that science should be consistent with Marxist-Leninist ideology." Volodya saw a flash of defiance in Zoya's eyes, but she dropped her gaze and said humbly,
"There can be no question that he is right.
We scientists must clearly redouble our efforts."
This was horseshit, and everyone in the room knew it, but no one would say so. The proprieties had to be observed.
"Indeed," said Grigori, "nevertheless, I will mention it next time I get a chance to talk to the Comrade General Secretary of the party. He may wish to look into it further."
"I hope so," said Zoya.
"We want to be ahead of the West."
"And how about after work, Zoya?" said Grigori cheerily. "Do you have a boyfriend, a fiancé, perhaps?"
Anya protested.
"Dad, that's none of our business."
Zoya did not seem to mind.
"No fiancé," she said mildly. "No boyfriend."
"As bad as my son Volodya. He too is single. He is 23 years old, well-educated, tall and handsome, yet he has no fiancé."
Volodya squirmed at the heavy-handedness of this hint.
"Hard to believe,"
Zoya said, and as she glanced at Volodya, he saw a gleam of humor in her eyes. Katerina put a hand on her husband's arm.
"Enough," she said. "Stop embarrassing the poor girl."
The doorbell rang.
"Again?" said Grigori.
"This time I have no idea who it might be," said Katerina as she left the kitchen.
She returned with Volodya's boss, Major Lemitov. Startled, Volodya jumped to his feet.
"Good evening, sir," he said. "This is my father, Grigori Peshkov,
Dad, may I present Major Lemitov?
Lemitov saluted smartly.
Grigori said, At ease, Lemitov. Sit down and have some chicken. Has my son done something wrong?
That was precisely the thought that was making Volodya's hand shake.
No, sir. Rather the contrary. But I was hoping for a private word with you and him.
Volodya relaxed a little. Perhaps he was not in trouble after all.
Well, we've just about finished dinner, Grigori said, standing up. Let's go into my study.
Lemitov looked at Ilya.
Aren't you in the NKVD? He said. And proud of it. Dvorkin is the name.
Ah, you tried to arrest Volodya this afternoon.
I thought he was behaving like a spy. I was right, wasn't I?
You must learn to arrest enemy spies, not our own.
Lemitov went out. Volodya grinned. This was the second time Dvorkin had been put down. Volodya, Grigori, and Lemitov crossed the hallway. The study was a small room, sparsely furnished. Grigori took the only easy chair. Lemitov sat at a small table. Volodya closed the door and remained standing. Lemitov said to Volodya,
Does your comrade father know about this afternoon's message from Berlin?
No, sir.
You'd better tell him.
Volodya related the story of the spies in Spain. His father was delighted.
Well done, he said. Of course, this might be disinformation, but I doubt it. The Nazis aren't that imaginative. However, we are. We can arrest the spies and use their radios to send misleading messages to the right-wing rebels.
Volodya had not thought of that. Dad may play the fool with Zoya, he thought, but he still has a sharp mind for intelligence work.
Exactly, said Lemitov. Grigori said to Volodya, Your school friend Werner is a brave man.
He turned back to Lemitov.
How do you plan to handle this?
We'll need some good intelligence men in Spain to investigate these Germans. It shouldn't be too difficult. If there really are spies, there will be evidence. Codebooks, wireless sets, and so on.
He hesitated.
I've come here to suggest we send your son.
Volodya was astonished. He had not seen that coming. Grigori's face fell.
Ah, he said thoughtfully, I must confess, the prospect fills me with dismay. We would miss him so much.
Then a look of resignation came over his face, as if he realized he did not really have a choice.
The defense of the revolution must come first, of course.
An intelligence man needs field experience, Lemitov said. You and I have seen action, sir, but the younger generation have never been on the battlefield.
True, true. How soon would he go?
In 3 days' time.
Volodya could see that his father was trying desperately to think of a reason to keep him at home, but finding none. Volodya himself was excited. Spain. He thought of blood-red wine, black-haired girls with strong brown legs, and hot sunshine instead of Moscow snow. It would be dangerous, of course, but he had not joined the army to be safe.
Grigori said, Well, Volodya, what do you think?
Volodya knew his father wanted him to come up with an objection. The only drawback he could think of was that he would not have time to get to know the stunning Zoya.
It is a wonderful opportunity, he said. I'm honored to have been chosen.
Very well,
said his father.
There is one small problem, Lemitov said. It has been decided that army intelligence will investigate, but not actually carry out the arrests. That will be the prerogative of the NKVD.
His smile was humorless.
I'm afraid you will be working with your friend Dvorkin.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached